Relatives by Chris van Wyk. Chris van Wyk was born in 1957 and grew up in a suburb called Rivoli in Johannesburg, where he still lives. At the age of 5, he told his parents that he wanted to become a writer, and he has done just that. He's written poetry, stories, and an autobiography describing his life. He says that his enjoyment of Skinner, gossip, has been part of his success as a writer. Relatives. When I was 21, I went down to the Cape to write a book. I had got it into my head that my first novel should be a family saga and that my own roots could be found in the arid dust of the Karoo, that famous semi-desert in the Cape, in a little town called Carnarvon. I had first gone down to Cape Town for a week. How could one travel all the way to the Cape without a trip to the most beautiful city in the world? Table Mountain, the train ride from Simonstown to the city, meandering along the beach, the beautiful coloured girls with their lilting, sing-song voices. Then back to Hutchinson Station in the heart of the Karoo to be picked up by my grandfather's younger brother, Henkie. A bigger version of my opa, Uncle Henkie's other difference was that he had mischief in his eyes where my opa had brooding shadows. Then followed an hour's drive to Carnarvon by way of long, hot, dusty, potholed roads past waving poor people on foot or pushing bicycles and carrying bundles of wood or things wrapped in newspaper. Carnarvon was a place in the middle of nowhere where nothing happened. Simple breakfasts, lunches and suppers were linked together by chains of cigarettes and conversations consisting of long, trailing life histories that made the old men in their elbow patches stammer and squint into the past from behind their thick spectacles as they dredged up anecdotes from the dry riverbeds of history. Oh, how wonderful it was listening to those minutely detailed sagas. But after 2 weeks, I was bored out of my wits. The novel could wait, I decided as I packed up and was driven back to Hutchinson Station. The train from Cape Town, the very same one that had brought me there 2 weeks before, slid into the station. I bade Uncle Henkie goodbye with a promise that I would feature him prominently and truthfully in my novel. When the train slithered out, I turned to the passengers in the compartment with whom I was going to spend the next 16 hours or so on the way to Johannesburg. There were 3 young men, 2 bearded, 2 chubby. If you think I can't count, remember the riddle of the 2 fathers and the 2 sons who each shot a duck? Only 3 ducks were shot. Why? Because one was a grandfather, the other a father, and the last a son. The man in the middle was both a father and a son. Got it? All youthful and exuberant, they were drinking beer straight from the can, and their conversation was full of the hammers and nails of their profession and punctuated with laughter and inane arguments. None of them swore, and they all flashed smiles at me, accepting me into their midst with an easy friendliness. "You been to Cape Town?" one of them inquired. "Yeah," I said, shoving my bag into the space above the door among their own bags and stuff. "Then you must have got your quota of 10 girls," he said with a wink. Of course, I knew exactly what he was talking about. In the mother city, there were at least 10 girls to every boy. I gave them a supercilious nod, hoping to convey the impression that I had certainly got my fair share. The truth of it was very different. All I could truly claim was a brief encounter with Marina, a nurse from Tigerberg Hospital. She had allowed me to kiss her in the back seat of her cousin's car, but my beer breath had proved too much for her, and after administering a violet-flavored beachy, she bade me good night and told me to come and see her in the morning. There were 2 other passengers in the compartment. They were not quite as friendly as the trio from the Cape. They sat huddled in a corner, muttering in undertones and casting sidelong glances down the green SAR leather seat at me and my new buddies. They were brothers. This was obvious from their identical features. sandy hair that had been cut so short that the hairs grew in sharp italic spikes. They both had dark, brooding eyes and thick, pouting lips. They wore khaki shirts and pants. "Try to describe people you meet on a bus or train," it said in the writer's manual. I slipped a blank sheet into my mental typewriter and went to town. They sit huddled in the corner of the compartment, bent so low in their conniving that they almost stick to the green South African Railways leather like two unsightly stains. They are identical, but for the fact that there is a 2 or 3 year difference between them. Juveniles in khaki, they look like fugitives from a Boy Scout patrol. Runaways not prepared to abide by the rules of the Lord Baden-Powell. Stripped of their badges, their epaulettes, their scarves, banished to ride forever, second class on the Trans-Karoo. As I've said, I was only 21 at the time. I turned away from them and back to the three big men who were asking me questions as if I was an old buddy. I was surprised and pleased by this unexpected attention and friendliness. One of them glanced at his watch from time to time and stared out of the window at the scrub that made up the dry, lonely landscape of the Karoo. They asked me how the journey down to the Cape had been. They all seemed genuinely interested. One of them slid a can of beer across the little panelite table. They all sat forward to listen to what I had to say. I lit a cigarette, passing the pack around to my three friends. Then I began a story which I had already tested on my uncle in Carnarvon. There, among seasoned storytellers, it had passed my litmus test. Listenable, interesting, telling, meaningful, unusual, strange. I knew I had a winner. On my way down from Johannesburg, my traveling companion, no one else had been booked into our compartment, had been a Capetonian man. He traveled in a flamboyant striped yellow and white suit. Every time he spoke, he injected an air of drama into the compartment. And when he was quiet, he seemed all the time to be sizing me up. I remember his name, Georgie Abrahams, from Elsie's River. As the train started its long journey out of Johannesburg Station, Georgie began to tell me how he had once killed a man. Where? In a compartment exactly like the one he and I were sitting in, facing each other. Why? Because, Georgie was very eager to explain, the skellum tried to steal some of Georgie's possessions. Food, money, an expensive watch. I can't remember what it was, but Georgie caught him, beat him up, sliced him from his greasy fat neck down to his klein chaiki, Georgie's words. He threw the remains of the dead man out of the window in the dead of night and wiped the blood carefully from the window pane, the green leather seat, the floor. When the conductor questioned the whereabouts of the missing man, Georgie merely shrugged and uttered a melodious, "How should I know? Nobody asked me to take care of him." But even as Georgie was relating this tale of theft and murder in all its horrific detail, I knew it was a lie. Simply a more elaborate version of my mother's dire warnings to yours truly at 7. If you eat in bed, you'll grow horns. Or the more convincing, go to bed with wet hair and you'll suffer from a smelly nose for the rest of your life. Georgie was in fact warning me to stay clear of his luggage. And the story had quite an amusing ending. When we reached Cape Town Station, a toothless woman in a lopsided jersey, stretched to twice its original size, which used to be extra large, welcomed the murderer home with an unceremonious slap across his face, while I looked on, together with a brood of his startled children, who didn't know if they should laugh with delight at their papa's homecoming or cry for the humiliating onslaught he was being subjected to. "Sis, Manda and Jay scrafe nix, phone nix, not a bloody word from Joe." My companions chuckled. They couldn't decide what was better, my story or my Cape accent. I looked at the two sulking boys in the corner. They'd followed the entire story, but they refused to laugh. So what? It hadn't been for their amusement anyway. But then my journey took an unexpected turn. An hour or two from Hutchinson, my three companions got up, stamped the pins and needles out of their feet, swept the crumbs from their pants, and began to gather up their luggage. They shook my hand, slapped my back, and said goodbye. And at the next station, they were gone. It all happened so quickly that I was a little stunned. Now, it was just me and the kids in khaki. And then a strange thing happened. I suddenly knew why they were dressed in khaki. In all probability, they were from a Cape Town reformatory on their way home to Johannesburg. Why had I not realized this simple fact before? The answer was elementary. I'd been far too preoccupied with my new friends to pay too much attention to these two boys, and there were no guardians in sight. But now that I was alone, I focused my attention full square on these two, and in an instant, I realized where they were from. The two juvenile delinquents also seemed to undergo some transformation. They no longer muttered, but spoke loudly, spicing their conversation with vulgarities. And, in an act of territorial imperative, they claimed more than their fair share of the confined space, stretching their stocky legs along the seats, putting their luggage everywhere, littering the floor with clothes and greasy food packets. Then they began a conversation which froze my blood. Their brother, the leader of a gang, had been killed by a rival gang in a Johannesburg township called Coronationville. They'd been given a weekend off to attend the funeral. They would bury their brother like the hero that he was, but they vowed to avenge his death before the soil on his grave hardened. They even had an argument about how this murder would be carried out. A slow cutting of the throat was the younger's plan. No, the elder brother disagreed. Stab him about 100 times, but from the ankles to the neck. As these plans were being discussed, they kept looking me straight in the eye, as if challenging me to say anything in protest or disagreement. Each time I looked away, not daring to utter a word. Meanwhile, the train seemed to be riding into the sunset. A cool breeze replaced the warmth, and the grim brothers felt the cold and pulled up the windows. I began to worry. How could I spend an entire night in a pitch-black compartment with two juvenile delinquents? Maybe I could go out in search of the conductor and ask to be moved to another compartment. But if I did that, my two little gangsters would know instinctively what I was up to. This also meant leaving my luggage unattended. As these thoughts went through my head, I looked down from the top bunk and saw the elder brother staring at me. He knows what I'm thinking, I thought. Darkness came and we turned on the lights. A caterer opened our door and read out the menu for supper. The two boys ordered steak, buttered bread, and potato salad. I had no appetite. The caterer left, and I heard him whistling down the corridor and opening the compartment next door. My companions glared at me again. They seemed to know why I had not ordered a meal. On my way down to the Cape, Georgie Abrams had joked about committing murder. This time there was no such threat, towards me anyway. But for every dark kilometre to Joburg, I felt that my home city was moving further and further away. You! I looked down from the bunk. It was the elder brother who was demanding my attention. Yeah, I answered as casually as my voice would allow. Are you not Auntie Rhea's child? Grandchild? Yes! I could not believe my ears. Auntie Rhea, as they called her, was indeed my grandmother and the mother of my own mother. I knew it was you when I saw you, he said, not smiling but with some friendliness in his voice. His brother stared up at me with some interest. You, that clever boy, used to read books and write stuff, hey? Yes, but who are you? Me and him, we're Auntie Visa's grandchildren. Auntie Visa was my granny's sister. Then we're cousins, I said. This wasn't quite true, but I was desperate to be as closely related to them as possible. When their food arrived, they insisted that I join them, and I did, for suddenly my appetite had returned. I'd forgotten all about my chance encounter with my two delinquent relatives until the other day, 3 years later. I opened the newspaper and read a report about rampant gang crime in the streets of Western Township and adjacent Coronationville. The article spoke of streets running with the blood of gangsters, the death of innocents caught in the crossfire, the revenge killings, the tragic futility of it all. The writer paid particular attention to the two brothers who had been stabbed to death and who now lay dead in the same graveyard as their brother killed 3 years ago. They had never reached 21. The end.